The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and it is time for Civics 101, the podcast refresher course on the basics that you may have forgotten or slept through in school. Tax season is over unless you filed an extension or work for what is perhaps the most dreaded of federal agencies. You know, the one you most often hear as a punchline and that most strictly enforces our civic duty. The IRS. Guiding us through is Joe Thorndike. He's director of the Tax History Project at Tax Analysts. And Joe, what a job you have.
Yeah, it's not one that many people have. It's one of those little tiny niches.
Well, I'm glad you're here. For our purposes today, give us a quick snapshot of the IRS today. Is it the largest bureaucracy? Which department oversees it? Some of the basics.
Well, you know, officially, it's part of the Treasury Department. It is not the largest federal agency, but one of the largest. And more to the point, it's probably the most important for most regular Americans. This is the main point of contact between Americans and the federal government. I mean, if you think about it, what other agency touches your life so directly, you know, and threatens to put you in jail regularly? I mean, it's unusual, right?
Yes, it's not a loving relationship in many ways. The IRS got its name when? 1950s, I think. Before that, it was called the Bureau of Internal Revenue.
Right. It was renamed in the 50s, partly to just because they were in the middle of a big reorganization and wanted to communicate that, but also to try to say, hey, we're about service. You know, we're not all about putting people in jail. We're also about taxpayer service. And that is actually a big part of the agency's job, because you'll hear this sometimes. We have a voluntary tax system. That means that our compliance is done by us, not by the agency. So they've got to be helpful to us.
When was the Bureau of Internal Revenue created, and why?
So the agency first appeared in 1862, and you know what's unusual about that is that the first income tax was actually imposed in 1861, and the tax came due at the end of June back then in 1862, but there was no agency to collect it yet. So I always say that's the most unusual thing about it, is that the first income tax was never collected because there was no one to take the checks. But the next year, they kind of got their act together. They passed a new income tax and they created an agency, the Bureau of Internal Revenue, to collect it. That was 1862.
Now, I guess President Abraham Lincoln pushed the income tax along with excise taxes to pay for the war. Was it intended to stick around after the Civil War?
Well, really, you know, the driving force came from Congress. But yeah, it was really intended as a war measure. We'd never had an income tax in the U.S., although the British had had one for 60 years at that point. But in the U.S., we hadn't, and they saw this as an emergency tax. It was a way to balance more regressive taxes. So most of the taxes were on consumption, excise taxes on things like, you know, alcohol, tobacco, and actually almost everything during the Civil War. But they wanted something that was more progressive, and that was the income tax. That's why they created it, as a balance.
Was existence of an income tax and the IRS ever seriously challenged as an affront to the Constitution?
Well, several times. So, you know, during wars, these things tend to get papered over pretty effectively. So not, for instance, during the Civil War very much. But then after the war was over, they let it expire again. You know, emergency tax. Now the emergency is over. Let's let it go. There were people asking for one after that. Progressives, or we would call them liberals today, but progressives and populists and people like that. And eventually they got another one enacted, and the Supreme Court struck it down as unconstitutional. And the grounds for that decision were fairly technical. And it was really only a stopping point on the way to actually having a permanent income tax. So, yes, people have complained pretty regularly about this. But what really put the end to those arguments was the 16th Amendment, which established once and for all that Congress had the right to impose an income tax.
And when was that?
That was in 1913. And then later that year, they actually got around to imposing an income tax. So like the amendment says, yeah, you've got the power. And then Congress a couple months later said, OK, here's the tax. And that's why our first income tax was levied that year.
So after the 16th Amendment, giving Congress the power to lay and collect taxes, how did that change the Bureau of Internal Revenue?
Well, the Bureau got a lot of new stuff to do. They had a lot of new taxpayers all of a sudden. Now, in the beginning, the tax is really narrow, only applies to a relative handful of Americans. And that's true, you know, up till the World War I, and then it gets broader and bigger. And then, but it's still, it's pretty minor tax. It's a rich man's burden, basically, right? And that doesn't really change until World War II, when the number of taxpayers increases like sevenfold in a few years. Millions of new people start paying the tax. The saying is that it went from being a class tax to a mass tax. And that's when the Bureau of Internal Revenue became a fact of life for regular Americans, for middle class Americans in particular.
One of the things I also found really surprising is that the IRS was the agency charged with enforcing prohibition, which is really a seedbed for crime. So they're handling billions of dollars as an organization, open to corruption, certainly. Is there evidence or charges historically of corruption?
I mean, the agency has had corruption scandals surrounding it at various points. I mean, they're fond of pointing out, actually, that it took an accountant to catch Al Capone. That used to be a recruiting poster for the IRS. But to be sure, there have been periodic scandals. There were scandals about, you know, the whiskey tax in the 1800s. There was actually a major scandal in the 1950s when more than 100, I think, IRS employees were prosecuted for corruption. But as you point out, they handle a lot of money. They have a lot of power. You would expect there to be a fair amount of corruption. I think what's sort of remarkable is that there hasn't been more, which isn't to say that there hasn't been any. Right? So it's a recurring theme. And a lot of the time, corruption gets blurred with sort of more generalized unhappiness about the agency and how powerful it is and how it wields that power.
Joe Thorndike is with us from the Tax History Project and walking us through the history of the Internal Revenue Service, or IRS. Joe, I'm interested in knowing more about the political power of the IRS, many charges that it has been used as a tool or a threat. FDR is said to have used the IRS as a weapon against his political foes. Is that true?
A variety of presidents have sort of meddled in the operations of the IRS. You know, there have been legal restrictions on that almost from the beginning, although they weren't necessarily so effective at first. And FDR has certainly been identified as one person who liked to use tax information against his opponents.
Like how? As, you know, he just threatened audits?
He would kind of send the IRS to look at somebody. I mean, I remember when I was researching my book, there was one moment where FDR says to his Treasury Secretary, "I'd like a list of the top 50 taxpayers in, you know, 1942. I can't remember which year it was, but roughly around then. No names, of course, right?" And then they give him a memo which includes all the names. Roosevelt was famous for a lot of sort of anti-loophole, anti-tax avoidance crackdowns. And in 1937, I mean, he had the Treasury write him this memo. Again, there were two versions, one that had the names and one that didn't. But they made sure that those names made their way into the public sphere and that these guys were called out for using, you know, special little loopholes to try to avoid their taxes.
I want to key into this thing you said about getting information, you know, no names, of course. But there have been other cases of, like, J. Edgar Hoover, for example, his counterintelligence project, going for names, having access to IRS files. Is that legal or was that always done in an underhanded way?
No, there was more fluidity in terms of sharing information back in the day. And I think the trend has been increasingly toward limiting the availability and the dissemination of taxpayer information. And since the Nixon years, there have been really very strict rules about how you can share tax information. Basically, the agency is barred from releasing publicly and even to other members of other parts of the federal government, any information about individual taxpayers without special authorization. So, I mean, one thing the IRS is actually very good at is protecting taxpayer information.
Is that why the IRS does not have authority, for example, to release Donald Trump's tax returns?
They can't release Donald Trump's tax returns. They can't even say whether Donald Trump has filed a tax return. They can't say anything at all. You can't acknowledge whether someone is a taxpayer or not.
The seriousness of the agency is not often undersold, but this kind of access, their kind of dogged pursuit, I mean, this is a force for good, for accountability and uncovering abuse and uncovering corruption. Can we get some props for the IRS?
I mean, I think it is good. Look, I mean, no one likes paying taxes, right? We all have to do it because somebody has to pay the bills. But that means that we want to make sure that everyone else is paying their fair share. And that's why I called my book that, right? I mean, that's the central trope of tax paying in America, their fair share. Sometimes that's treated as like, oh, I just want those rich guys to pay their fair share. But it's really about all of us. We all have to carry this communal burden of, you know, this fiscal responsibility. I call it, you know, like fiscal citizenship is a way to think about it. And the IRS is the agency that makes that real. It makes sure that we are all doing what we're supposed to do and that none of us are shirking our responsibilities. We couldn't do it without them because, you know, Americans are really remarkably good about paying their taxes. We have very high compliance rates relative to other countries. But that doesn't mean we would if no one was looking over our shoulder.
Well, how about the evaders? We have a very strong libertarian tradition here in New Hampshire, a lot of pride in not having a state income or sales tax. And even a history of armed standoffs. There was a couple here called the Browns who held off federal marshals for 9 months from their hilltop fortress in Plainfield. They're in prison now. Do all tax cheats go to prison?
Well, not all tax cheats go to prison. I would say that a lot of tax cheats get caught. Again, if there's a paper trail that the IRS has access to, that makes it much more likely they're going to catch someone. I don't know. I think, you know, the important distinction here is really between evasion and avoidance. Tax avoidance is what every red-blooded American likes to do, and tax evasion is illegal, and you can go to jail for it. So I think the agency is actually quite good about enforcing the law against people who are breaking it. The agency has a much harder time enforcing the law against people who are bending it in ways that might reasonably be considered legal, but might reasonably not be legal. That's the hardest job the agency has, I think, is figuring out how to enforce the law when the law is not crystal clear.
Joe, you got your return done yet?
Oh, are you kidding? I have filed an extension every year. It's a busy time of year for me. I'm a tax guy.
Joe Thorndike, he's director of the Tax History Project for Tax Analysts, and he is also author of the book, Their Fair Share, Taxing the Rich in the Age of FDR, published by the Urban Institute Press. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, it was my pleasure.
During his run for president, Donald Trump declared himself the law and order candidate. Shortly after taking office, his administration identified standing up for our law enforcement community among its top six issues. On the trail, Trump vowed to nationalize the practice known as stop and frisk, a tactic ruled unconstitutional by a federal judge in 2013. Norm Stamper served as a police officer for 34 years and is former chief of the Seattle Police Department. Among the experiences he recalls in his book, To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police, is putting cops on the receiving end of stop and frisk. Norm, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
So the official name, field interrogation, commonly known as stop and frisk. First, clarify what it is and how long it's been used by law enforcement.
Well, in simple terms, it's the practice of police officers stopping people who they believe, about whom they have a reasonable suspicion, have been involved in crime, are committing a crime, or are about to commit a crime. So there's a legal justification for those stops. It's grounded in a Supreme Court case from 1968 called Terry v. Ohio. It's a legitimate police tool, but it has been abused in rather breathtaking ways from one jurisdiction to another throughout the country.
How so? Who was likely to be stopped and frisked? Take, for example, by the NYPD when the policy was in effect from 2004 to 2014.
Well, it the statistics in this case don't lie, and what they tell us, developing years' worth of data, is that young people, poor people, and people of color are overwhelmingly more likely to be stopped, questioned, and frisked by their local police department.
Overwhelmingly, it looks like 88% of those stops also totally innocent. 56% black people, 30% almost Latino, 11% white.
Yeah.
So you, Norm, you worked your way up the ladder. You were a beat cop in San Diego, and then you made your way up into the administration. And while there, beat cops went through the experience of stop and frisk as targets. What did the force look like at that point? This was back in 1973.
Well, it was a much smaller police force than it is today. The population was smaller. We had a law and order president, named a term that should be familiar to us all now.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a lot of pressure to do whatever it took to reduce crime. We randomly selected, under the careful guidance of an evaluation firm that had been hired by our grantor. This was a police foundation grant, and we selected 24, 25 police officers and put them through a class in field interrogation, communication skills, a wide variety of other skills that would help them effectively discern what might be reasonable suspicion. Then we took them to San Jose, about five officers at a time, and we put them on the streets in plain clothes under circumstances that we could calculate would be suspicious to police officers.
So like parking lots, liquor stores, closed
Absolutely.
Gas stations, that kind of
yeah.
thing?
If you're hanging around a closed business, for example, at 11:30 or 12 at night, that might be seen as suspicious. It might be completely innocent, but we were helping our officers understand what their legal justification might be for the stop.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted them to feel what it's like to be stopped and questioned and frisked.
So the San Jose cops, I guess, presumably took the bait. They would stop them.
In every case, they either took the bait or we placed a call to the dispatch center. That was by design
mm-hmm.
and through our confederates in the administration of the San Jose Police Department. They put out the word that sometime over the next, I've forgotten, 30 days, 60 days, we're going to have visitors from another jurisdiction. And they won't be just tourists. They will be police officers who are undergoing a study of field interrogation or stop and frisk.
So they go and check these suspicious people. Well, what happened with the officers who were in this experiment? What did they say about it?
Well, that was the most fascinating part of this, of course. One of my jobs, I was a lieutenant at the time overseeing this project, and had a colleague with me, and the two of us would divide up the officers after they had had their experience, put them in the front seat of a rental car, and the interviewer, the interlocutor, would sit in the back seat with a tape recorder running. And we would put that mic in their face and say, okay, what did it feel like when the officer approached you? And almost everyone, to an individual, said, I was scared.
Hmm.
I was really afraid. Now, these are seasoned police officers who are openly acknowledging that when a police officer approached them, that they were afraid of those officers, afraid for their safety.
Yeah, I'm looking at some of the notes here. My mouth went dry. My knees were shaking. I could see the gun on his hip. You know, when the police swooped down, I thought I was a goner.
Yeah.
So what did that do, that experience of being on the receiving end? Of course, we know, you know, it's very scary to be a cop when you're coming upon a suspicious situation. But then to be swooped down upon by a police officer, what do you think that experience did for those San Diego police?
It did two things fundamentally. One is that it humanized them, and a practice that for many had become rote, had become totally routine, and it developed empathy in them. And I dare say that every single one of them acknowledged over time that it had changed their practice.
Hmm.
It caused them to understand what it feels like to be on the receiving end of what many contend is an aggressive tactic, and to appreciate how important it is to start slow, to speak quietly, to explain their actions. And just doing those things can have an enormous positive effect on the entire interaction.
I'm speaking with Norm Stamper. He's a former Seattle police chief, and he's written a book called To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. He's a veteran of 34 years as an officer and in the top brass of police in the country. Here is then-candidate Donald Trump on the trail talking about the stop and frisk policy.
Now, whether or not in a place like Chicago you do stop and frisk, which worked very well, Mayor Giuliani is here, it worked very well in New York, it brought the crime rate way down. But you take the gun away from criminals that shouldn't be having it.
Questions came up after that statement about whether it did work well in New York City. It was ruled a violation of the Fourth Amendment ban against illegal search and seizure in a federal court. Norm, was it responsible for bringing the crime rate way down?
You're going to love this answer, and it is yes, no, and maybe. One of the problems with policing is that it's very difficult to measure non-events. In other words, if an aggressive stop and frisk policy has had narrowly defined a positive effect on crime rates, we don't really know that for sure. We do know that it has produced a chilling effect on many millions of people throughout this country who have been subjected to it indiscriminately. And when that happens, the trust between community and police drops. The willingness to come forward and report a crime or to say, yeah, I saw what happened, and serve as a witness also drops. And so we have a very mixed bag of results from the practice of stop and frisk.
Hmm. Well, of course,
one of the ways to eliminate a police tool that has legitimacy and importance to the effort to achieve public safety is to abuse that tool and lose it. And that has certainly happened in many parts of the country.
Well, the Trump administration has made some murmurings about being open to nationalizing the stop and frisk policy. First of all, is it possible to restore trust between communities and police with this policy? And would it be legal?
No and no. I think it's pretty much a given that Donald Trump, for all the powers of the presidency, does not have the authority to mandate stop and frisk as a police policy applied throughout the country. As a matter of fact, he is as bound by the Supreme Court decisions as the newest beat cop or the most senior police official. If he wants to improve everything from public safety to officer safety, he will honor Americans' civil liberties and bring to that campaign the same kind of enthusiasm that he shows with respect to stop and frisk.
I want to pull back to a higher view for just a moment. You know, we have a lot of data on black and brown people targeted by police. We know about high-profile police killings, especially 2014 to 15. Nationally, policing has become highly politicized, but it's framed as a kind of duality. You know, you're forced into a camp of either Black Lives Matter or Blue Lives Matter. How would you get at that, the maybe yes and instead of the yes, no, maybe part of that?
Well, we're clearly in that latter camp these days. There's really no question about that. I think the point at which Black Lives Matter merges with Blue Lives Matter, we will have arrived. And we're in no immediate danger of reaching that destination at this moment in our history. The tensions between those two social movements, exacerbated by a president who, without good knowledge and understanding of the practice of stop and frisk, certainly complicates things. I think one of the key features of today's community police relationship is that for the first time, white middle-class Americans have been able to see police practices that have only been described by official police spokespersons or by the media relying on official police accounts of incidents.
You mean in these, like, cell phone videos, for example?
That's precisely what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
For my book, I interviewed a young African-American man who had agreed to talk to me about the talk, which is to say the talk that his father had with him when he was as young as 4 years of age. And what he was saying, I asked him, well, we've seen the Michael Brown case, we've seen Laquan McDonald, we've seen Walter Scott in North Charleston, South Carolina. We have seen unarmed black men shot and killed by white police officers. Is it getting worse? And he said, not better, not worse, the same. He said, what's different today? And he tapped my iPhone, which I was using as a recorder, and said, this has made all the difference in the world.
Hmm. Well, you're writing about fixing a broken system at a time when police officers also feel targeted after high-profile killings and ambushes in Dallas and Baton Rouge, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So how are police officers looking at you? I mean, are they upset at you sort of crossing the line, the thin blue line, by saying, this really needs to be fixed?
I have heard, you know, I'm speaking in book tours, I have heard from police officers how much they appreciate the book and how much it validates the feelings, the motives, the aspirations that they had when they became police officers. And so many of them will say, well, what you're writing about, of course, is the way that it should be, but it's not, Norm, and you need to come to terms with the real world. And I'm always challenged by that kind of statement, that kind of criticism. I respect it. And in many cases, I do support it. Let's face facts. It's been many, many years since I was on the streets. But there are some universals. And there are some timeless policies and practices that can make policing safer. But we have to be completely honest with those policies and practices that are putting gaps filled with tension between our rank-and-file police officers and the citizens they serve.
Norm Stamper, a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Norm Stamper, he's former chief of police for the Seattle Police Department and author of the book To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. You can find a lot more about Norm and his background at our website. That's wordofmouthradio.org. That's all we have time for today. You can keep in touch on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio and on Twitter at Word of Mouth. Music in this episode came to us from Poddington Bear, Blue Dot Sessions, and Broke for Free. I'm Virginia Prescott, back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.